Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. We have everything you need to update your window treatments with Window Images blinds and shades. We carry vinyl, aluminum, and faux wood blinds, cellular shades, and more. Plus, get them trimmed to width in-store for free. Also, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. It's Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances and save an additional $1,000 when you buy four select LG major appliances. Plus, get a free DeWalt 20-volt max 5-amp-hour battery when you buy a select DeWalt 20-volt max tool. Get the job done for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/26. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for more details and qualifying items.
Light out, everybody.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your host, Austin.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
And we're back. We're back in the paranormal realm today. It's been a little while.
Yeah. It's nice getting these in here.
It is. It's something that I never get sick of, quite honestly.
Same.
It's just such a mysterious place to hang out. And today we're going to be focusing on a lot of different things,
really,
but all pertaining to the paranormal, including deathbed visions and like encounters with paranormal entities, spectral mist, really dealing with like end of life care of individuals, and especially healthcare workers who are there bedside, and some of their experiences, along with kind of understanding the realm of near-death experiences to some extent, but really focusing more on near-death awareness.
Yeah.
And some of the things that people reportedly see or hear or just encounter, it feels like. And then we're going to kind of switch things up. You're really getting a two-in-one episode today, because the first part of it's, you know, more of the medical paranormal encounters, but then we kind of switch into a full-blown tuberculosis hospital, Waverly Sanatorium, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the very, very, honestly, disturbing history there.
Yeah, dark period in history. I mean, tuberculosis, it's like one of the most deadly things on the planet.
Plague of all plagues.
Yeah, exactly.
As they say.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there might be a little exaggeration there around some of the stories coming out of there, per usual.
We will debunk a little bit of the rumors, but that's not to say we're debunking the place itself as a paranormal hotspot. But yeah, there's definitely, as it always is with a little folklore, it's exaggerated along the way.
Yep. So yeah, welcome. You get a two-in-one today. This will be really interesting. I mean, I think, you know, we've all had loved ones pass, and loved ones, you know, even been with loved ones in their final moments, and that whole experience is unlike anything else.
It's very sobering. Yeah,
it's it really puts things into perspective for you, and it also, you know, in the wake of some of the recent experiences I've had in a few years, has honestly made me more interested in the paranormal and what happens, you know, when you die or you're near death.
Yeah.
And, you know, people report a lot of different things. And that to me is, I think to some they'd find it creepy or unsettling, but I think for other people, they might find it comforting.
Really calming, yeah.
Because it's one of life's greatest mysteries. What's beyond, you know, the great unknown and the great veil after you leave this earth. And it's something that I find myself thinking about probably more than I should. I'm one of those just wanting, you know, I want to know so bad, but the more I get into it, the more I realize I'm probably not meant to know.
Yeah. Kind of got to submit to the mystery, right?
Right.
Accept it.
But it's interesting to dive into the science behind some of these experiences and encounters with paranormal entities, because I think we've learned a lot over the years, but there's still so much we don't know about what's really going on. So yeah, today we're going to dive into a lot of different paranormal topics here. So
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I also like this idea that, I mean, these are accounts that are basically verified by, you know, people of science. You know, these are hospice workers, these are medical care workers, and these strange, odd, inexplicable experiences are being witnessed by pretty grounded people, I'd say. If you go into, you know, science, medicine, I feel like you have a pretty practical, prescriptive approach to the world. So I find this fascinating that these people can verify these accounts.
Right, right. Yeah, that is really interesting. So we'll get into all of that. But I did want to quickly just say, you know, if you're a fan of Lights Out and you enjoy the wonderful show we put together every week, make sure you're following us on Spotify or subscribed on YouTube. We'd appreciate it. It takes 2 seconds. Really helps us out. But yeah, let's go ahead and get into things here. So to start things off, let's talk about one of the most common paranormal encounters in the medical field. It's a patient having their deathbed experience with a ghost, a phantom, or unusual vision. These experiences usually happen in the few weeks or even just a few hours before the patient's death. And one story comes from a clinical hospice social worker with the University of North Carolina Healthcare Hospice named Scott Jansen. For months, Scott had visited his patient, Evan, a man in his 90s who had been battling colorectal cancer for more than 4 years. And every time Scott visited, Evan complained of being extremely tired and depressed. And day after day, he got worse, and he began praying for death to finally arrive. He saw his long days of illness turning his life into a tedious, meaningless dirge. And he even mentioned ending his own life. I mean, it's just really tough in those final, you know, maybe months or even final years, when you're just...
You're ready to let go.
Yeah, you're just like, what's even the point anymore? And during one particular visit, Evan's depression seemed to have faded for a moment. He seemed unusually upbeat. And when Scott asked what was going on, Evan asked if he believed in ghosts. This didn't shock Scott at all because he had been familiar with unusual experiences when patients reached the end of their lives. These experiences included near-death or out-of-body experiences, visitations from paranormal beings, messages delivered through dreams, and synchronicities or strange behaviors by animals, birds, and even insects. Evan then told Scott a story of his time as a supply officer for a World War II combat hospital, and he said that his time in the war had soured him on the idea that anything good could come from humans. It had left him in a permanent state of feeling unsafe and alone. It was this time in his life that he always attributed to his depression. Evan described a cold fall day at the combat hospital. Casualties were coming in nonstop. Evan and the others scrambled to haul the blood-soaked men on stretchers from the rail cars into the triage where they could assess the injuries. Here they separated the injured into two groups, those who could survive their injuries and those who couldn't and would be left to die. By the time the last train arrived, Evan felt completely exhausted from hauling the injured men all day. His back hurt and his hands were numb from the cold. He and another man hauled one more guy from the last train when Evan's grip on the stretcher slipped. And when the injured man hit the ground, Evan saw the man's intestines oozing out of his wound, and he saw a burst of steam come out of the man, who then later died. That night, Evan cried in his bunk. He had seen countless men die during his time at the combat hospital, but that last one was overwhelming, and rightfully so. That must have been extremely traumatic. He cried so hard that night that his bunk shook, and when he finally looked up, that's when he saw a man sitting at the end of his bunk wearing a World War I uniform. And Evan can tell that he was a World War I soldier from his funny helmet, which their helmets, if you've never seen them, kind of look like little hats.
Yeah, they got the rims on them all the way around 360.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And the figure was covered in faint light, almost like he was glowing in the dark. According to Evan, the man simply looked at him and he experienced an overwhelming sense of love. He had never felt that kind of love before, and he felt like all the pain and cruelty he had suffered and seen firsthand wasn't even real. This entity ended up visiting Evan several more times, and each time he arrived, Evan could feel this overwhelming expression of love without any words ever being spoken, and the entity always left him with a sense of peace. After he returned home from his work at the World War II combat hospital, Evan says the visits had stopped. But after his mother died many years later, he had been looking through an old box of photographs. he spotted a man who looked suspiciously like the entity who had visited him. Apparently, it was his uncle Calvin, who was killed in combat during World War I in 1918. While on his own deathbed, Evan then told Scott that he was so happy because Calvin appeared to him once again, the previous night, at the foot of his bed. And this is why he was happy that day. And that particular night had been the one that entity spoke to him for the first time. He reassured Evan that he would help him over the hill and into the afterlife. Evan passed away soon after. So, one might think it's kind of creepy at first, but then to find out that it is his uncle, or he thinks it was his uncle.
Yeah, and that he's there to help, right?
Yeah, is weirdly comforting.
I know, I feel like ghosts kind of have a bad reputation.
Yeah.
Like they're always terrifying, out to get us for some reason, but I kind of like how this flips the narrative.
Well, I think also just the term ghost, what is that?
Ooh, spooky, scary.
Spooky ghosts, but really we're talking about spirits, spirits of the dead.
Right.
These visions or manifestations often occur along with nearing death awareness and have been given the official name end-of-life dreams and visions, or ELDVs. Others have named the experience informally as the death clock ghost, which sounds scary.
Sounds metal.
I want to meet the death clock ghost.
Right.
It's like, thinking about meeting the Grim Reaper.
Right, yeah.
That's not very comforting.
No.
It's going to freak you out.
Yep. But this is incredibly common. About 50% to 60% of hospice patients report a visitation by someone who is not there. This is according to the National Institutes of Health. So according to Dr. Peter Fenwick, who's a renowned neuropsychiatrist and neurophysiologist, he said that over half of the people who have experienced ELDVs didn't even know they were ill and passed soon after the vision. These are not to be confused with near-death experiences because they typically occur when a patient is fully conscious and has not experienced a sense of having left the body. In many of these experiences, people report being lucid, completely lucid, like they're awake and they just see the vision.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
And some didn't even know, like he said, some didn't even know that they were ill or about to die and they still see these visions.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that odd?
Because I think we've all heard of, NDEs or near-death experiences, but again, you're usually, you're unconscious during those. You're in a coma.
Right.
You're not lucid like that. Like
right.
That's wild. ELDVs.
Yeah, ELDVs. Rebecca Valla, a psychiatrist in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, wrote, quote, "Those who are dying and seem to be in and out of this world and the next one often find their deceased love in the present and they communicate with them. In many cases, the pre-deceased loved ones seem to be aiding them in their transition to the next world." In a 2014 study, researchers interviewed 59 patients admitted to a hospice inpatient unit between January 2011 and July 2012. Most of the participants reported experiencing at least one dream or vision. Almost half of the dreams or visions occurred while asleep. Nearly all patients indicated they felt real. The most common included deceased friends or relatives, or even living friends or relatives. Some even reported visions of their pets. And out of those who experienced the visions, those who experienced the deceased were significantly more comforting than those of the living. So that's like if you're on your deathbed and a living relative comes to you, it's like, oh, they're glad they're there. But when they actually see a vision of someone who's dead, some have reported it's even more comforting to see that.
Which makes sense. I mean, if you're right there, then I can't help but think in those moments, I'd be thinking about what's next, and it'd be difficult to even focus on the present or the living because you're so close
to the
other side that you want to know, and to see somebody who's already passed would be very comforting because then you're like, well, at least it doesn't just go black, at least there is some form of an afterlife here.
Yeah, it's like kind of confirming that to people, right?
Right.
So they also reported that those who were closer to death experienced more visions.
But is it all in our head? Because I can see somebody, arguing who maybe believes that after you die, it just goes black. It's basically you return to a state as, from what you came, which was, you don't remember life before birth. It was blacked in.
Yeah.
So is it just that?
I wish that that study ran which patients were maybe already believed in an afterlife and then were experiencing these visions, and those who didn't, there was any discrepancies there or change in who was seeing what, or if it was comforting versus not. Because I imagine if you're already predisposed to believing that there is an afterlife, that might also play into this a little bit.
It'd be interesting to hear from somebody who doesn't believe in an afterlife.
Who then witnessed this
or just get their thoughts.
You know?
Like, what are you thinking about?
Right, yeah. Where do you think that vision came from? Yeah. Mm.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Yeah, so Jim May, a licensed clinical social worker in Durham, North Carolina, noticed that family members and patients are frequently surprised by these deathbed visitors. Many are confused and need help understanding what's going on. So he's not only saying, like, the people experiencing it are surprised, they're also saying, obviously, like, the family members. Wouldn't that be odd? You know, you come in and, you know, your loved one is talking about visions. I think that would be really confusing. So Jim actually encourages the family members to go along with the experience because, quote, whatever they are experiencing is real to them. So it's almost not even a question of, is this a paranormal entity? Is this a hallucination? It's more like he's just saying, either way, you have to go along with this because something's happening with them. And since we can't really explain
tell
it.
Tell which way it's going. I mean, what are you going to do? Seeing things.
Shut up, Grandma. You can't, like, you have to go along with it because this is a part of the dying process to some degree. So since most patients can find the interactions with these experiences to be comforting, Jim May explains that minimizing, dismissing, or trying to pathologize these interactions can be harmful and traumatic, right? That makes sense. In a 2015 TED Talk with Christopher Kerr, the chief medical officer at the Center for Hospice and Palliative Care in Buffalo, he mentioned one of his terminally ill outpatients talking about their visions. The woman said, quote, "My mom and dad, my uncle, everybody I knew that was dead was there. I remember seeing every piece of their face." Apparently, the woman was wide awake and lucid at the time of this vision. So here's actually, I mean, to put even more credit to this, here's Oklahoma local news interviewing some doctors and hospice workers who have witnessed their patients experiencing ELDVs.
Folks that are dying still can have hallucinations, but they are qualitatively and quantitatively different.
If you try to get their attention and you call them out of that, there's like a transition back to this world, and they don't like it.
About 2 weeks prior, her son had passed away, and they decided, because of her condition, they weren't going to bother telling her. Her sister, Dorothy, walked in, said, "Margaret," she said, "you look beautiful. What's going on?" She said, "Charles came to see me, and he said he's coming back to take me with him." And she didn't know that. He had passed away 2 weeks before. And the very next day, she passed away as well.
A lot of times I notice a difference in the feeling from right before they pass away to after they pass away.
That was weirdly uplifting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Especially... I know there's a lot of people out there who have an immense fear of death.
Sure.
And
I think we have a natural disposition for that, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, nobody to understand what it means to not exist is impossible for our brains to conceive. You know, we're like, what?
Yeah.
What do you mean I don't exist?
Yeah.
What does that look like? And to think that you may be led into an afterlife by a loved one, I think is best case scenario in my book.
Yeah, like, seriously.
I can't think of any better way to move on from this body than to be led by somebody who's already passed, like a grandparent, a mother, a father, a brother, sister, whoever it may be.
Or even if there is no afterlife, even just having them there and just, hey, we'll comfort you into non-existence is also nice to think about.
Yeah. This whole thing brings me back to the theory around paranormal activity being an imprint. You know what I mean? Like, if that's a real thing and some of the paranormal activity is this imprinted energy, you know, that's residual, that's left over from an event or a person or something like that, or, you know, it's like a tape playing over and over.
Stone
tape theory. Yeah. If that has any credence to it, it almost makes you wonder if that tape starts playing, you know, as you're getting close to the end, you know, and maybe that's what you're experiencing is sort of that phenomenon. And maybe that isn't necessarily a determining factor to whether or not an afterlife exists, but it's sort of this just process that exists. And, you know, we don't understand it, but it's just something that's there that, you know, lots of people experience, which still very comforting. And
yeah, agreed.
So there's a journalist named Stephen Petro who witnessed his own mother having similar experiences on her deathbed in 2016. One day while visiting her in hospice, she greeted him with a big smile as he entered the room. And almost like she was interrupted as he entered, she then picked back up on a conversation with her mother, who had died in 1973. He also noticed that his mother had changed her tone and began talking in a young girl's voice. At first, these conversations freaked Stephen out, which I'd be freaked out too, along with his brother, sister, and their father. Stephen wondered if this was a sign of advancing dementia, which his mother had been diagnosed with, or if she was preparing for death in a strange way. Once he looked more into it, he discovered that speaking with ghosts was a sign that death was around the corner. This is when he got in contact with Jim May, the clinical social worker of 14 years. Studies show that a combination of physiological, pharmacological, and psychological explanations can explain the ghosts. It's hard to gather physical, empirical evidence for whether or not people on their deathbeds are in fact experiencing what we'd consider a quote-unquote ghost. But in the end, it's less important to prove whether or not the ghost is real and more important to know how to respond appropriately when a loved one is experiencing near-death awareness.
Right. Agreed completely.
Yeah. Yeah. So Stephen, he continued to visit his mother over the months, and the paranormal experience escalated over time. By the fall of 2016, Stephen's mother greeted him by name and spoke coherently for several minutes. But then she turned to a bookcase near her bed and began cooing an invisible baby. She said that the baby was her own and was very sick. She asked if Stephen could do anything for her. He had already learned not to correct his own mother, whether her perception was skewed by dementia or something else. So Stephen would play along with it and take the baby to the kitchen for a bottle to feed her. As the weeks passed, his mother's perceived baby became more difficult. He'd have to give her an imaginary bottle, cradle her, and pretend to take her to the doctor. One day, Stephen asked his mother if he thought that the baby was her, and she quickly responded, "Yes, the baby is hurting."
So in this case, it's a vision of themselves as a child. I find that fascinating as well. The largest survey of medical professionals to date shows that deathbed visions, quote, occur across cultures, which is important, tend to be of short duration, and that in 62% of cases reported in their study, the patient died within 24 hours of reporting or showing signs of such a vision. So, like we mentioned, these experiences can bring a sense of comfort to patients and families and help reduce death anxiety. Another common feature is that these, you know, visitors often mention that they have arrived to accompany the patients on a journey or into another mode of existence, possibly into an afterlife. And these visions often occur within the last weeks to possibly hours of a person's life. Many have tried to find conventional explanations like hallucinations. That's an obvious one, you know, brought on by maybe a terminal disease or something. Certain opioid medications have been connected to these, or altered mentation due to the extreme stress of dying. But some argue that these visions tend to be, quote, thematically and sequentially coherent. They have contextual meaning and usually bring positive emotional states, which is unlike hallucinations often associated with medication or confused states, right?
Yeah.
Because those are typically illogical, fragmentary, rarely involve a deceased loved one, and they're often described as distracting, distressing, or irritating, right? So it's not like a conventional hallucination.
Yeah, and I don't know of any prescription medications that have a side effect of you may meet your dead loved one.
Right,
you know, yeah. Like, that is a good distinction to make.
Yeah,
that they, yeah. It's usually distracting, distressing, confusing, or irritating.
Not comfortable, right?
Right, yeah.
So that's a good point. While many deathbed visions can often bring peace and comfort, in some cases, a visitor can cause the dying person anxiety or intensify that fear of death. And this might have been true in Stephen's mother's case. Obviously, if she's saying, like, I'm this baby and I'm hurting, this may have been kind of a manifestation of her stress. But with each passing day, his mother became more distressed about the baby, who she saw as herself. So he tried to distract her with things like family, news, and cooking. And one night he made a simple dinner of spaghetti with store-bought marinara sauce and a salad. And his mother only ate with her husband and Stephen. But oddly enough, later that night when Stephen helped her to bed, she told him that was exactly how she wanted her funeral to be. She said, quote, "You invited all my favorite people, and the food was just what I would have ordered." She passed 6 weeks later, and they served pasta and salad at her service. I find that weird because she said, "You invited all my favorite people." The likelihood of all her favorite people just being Stephen and her father, probably not likely, right? She may have been witnessing a bunch of family members at the table, right?
Wow. You have a story, don't you, Danny?
Yeah, actually, my fiance, Anna Lee, worked in hospice when she got out of high school around like 18 or 19 years old. And she had a similar experience with a man named Harold. Harold was a hardworking man and had unfortunately been experiencing a long and drawn-out hospice, and his wife had died 4 years prior to this. One evening, around 2 to 3 a.m., she had heard Harold laugh from his connecting den across the hall. When she came into his room, he told her his twin white Westies, his two dogs, were playing on an armchair further away from his bed. They were being rowdy, and he was trying to get their attention to calm them down. At that point, he told Anna Lee that his wife was arriving to come pick him up and to go make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. She did what she was told, and she left the room to make the sandwich. When she returned, Harold had passed. She called the time of death, the family, and an ambulance. She said that she would never forget Harold's warm smile and how he was not scared, but excited.
Mm.
And she believes that the reason she was told to go make a sandwich is that so she didn't have to watch Harold pass, and Harold could pass with his loved ones.
Yeah. He got to see his wife his wife was coming to, you know, pick him up, and then he got to see his dogs. Man, I hope I get to see my dogs at the end. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially all the dogs. You probably have multiple dogs over the course of your life, right?
Yeah.
That'd be kind of cool, actually. Yeah. Every pet you've ever had is also there.
Yes. Yeah. My turtle Mo. I hope he shows up.
Yeah. My little gecko.
Yeah.
But have either of you guys ever been with somebody when they, you know, at the moment that they passed?
I've never been there.
Really?
I've been with my dog, but I've never been like in the room with a person dying.
It's, I had the, I call it the pleasure, and honor to be with, Annalie and Kendall's grandmother, in her final moments. And I was sitting next to her on the bed, just kind of holding her hand. She was kind of definitely in a similar state of just, she wasn't verbal or anything, but both Kendall and I believed that she acknowledged that we were there. And I remember watching her literally take her last breath, and it like forever changed me and really provided, it was a really tough thing in the moment to experience, and just, it was so overwhelming and like almost surreal.
Yeah.
But afterwards, when I had some time to reflect on it, I felt extremely privileged to have been there for her when she took that final breath. And it was, it was unlike any experience. You know, there's only a few experiences in life that I would say have been life-changing. One being that, and then obviously the birth of my daughter is, and it's interesting to compare the two experiences, see life brought into the world and life leaving the world. Mm-hmm. And there's something so inherently special about it. And as sad as that moment was, it was also, you almost felt like a weight lifted off of not only our shoulders, but just a weight lifted off of her shoulders when she finally like left her body. And I'll never forget it. It's something that'll stick with me forever. Cause I was like, hey guys, I think she just took her final breath, and everybody came over and they're like, oh yeah, she's gone. But I was the one who, I was just happened to be looking at her, like just looking at her in the eyes. And then she took this one final breath, and it was, and then I knew right away she was gone. And yeah, it's a very, I think it could be perhaps traumatic for some people. And I think maybe in the moment it was for me, but it was also this comforting feeling knowing that she was at peace and that she, you know, it's unfortunate, but a lot of elderly people suffer in those final, mm-hmm. You know, final moments and final months or whatever it may be. And so to finally know that she was at peace and not, you know, in her body that was, you know, not serving her anymore was a really proud moment of mine. The mood down.
This
Harold story just kind of reminded me of that experience.
I had a similar story like with my grandmother. I wasn't in the room when she passed because she passed away really, really late at night. But I remember, you know, it's like that classic like conventional deathbed where all the family's kind of cycling in and saying their goodbyes and everything. And yeah, it's very sobering, and it kind of, the clarity in the room is like, it's so sober, and it puts life itself into perspective. You know, you get to just, nothing else really matters. You know, you can kind of push everything aside and focus on that experience quite a lot. But it's powerful.
It is. And it gives you the motivation to live.
Yeah.
You know, it gives you that push of like, life is short. And I think the concept of time comes in.
Yeah.
And you start really, because you know, your grandparents always tell you, oh, it went by so fast.
And, mm-hmm.
you know,
and when you're a kid, you're like, what?
Yeah, time is slow when you're a kid. Mm-hmm. And then as you get older and become an adult, you know, it feels like time's speeding up, but it's really just you're busier and you got more going on. So
the
time slips by, but it really hits you like, whoa. I don't know. Maybe that's just me, but I'm like,
no.
I will be here before I know it. I will be in this exact same
position. It's fleeting. Yeah.
It is. And so it's just
savor it.
Yeah. Savor it and, you know, live life, man.
Yeah.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
But another common deathbed paranormal phenomenon that medical staff have encountered is known as the mist and life phenomenon. Dr. Raymond Moody, who's famously known for pioneering research into near-death experiences, ended up coming across a common phenomenon that occurs just above a deathbed. Some have reported they see what looks like smoke or subtle steam hovering. Sometimes it appears to have a human shape. It often drifts upward and disappears fairly quickly, but not all eyewitness accounts are the same. This is fascinating to me because I definitely did not experience that or see any sort of phenomenon like this occur when I was with their grandmother. But this concept it's hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
in so many ways. But Dr. Moody told of his own experience when his mother died. He was in his mother's room along with other family members who gathered around her bed, and all of them witnessed an unusual light near the bed. Dr. Moody said it looked like a light in a swimming pool at night. In his book, Glimpses of Eternity, co-authored by Paul Perry, they reported on a Georgia doctor who witnessed this phenomenon twice near his deceased patients. As the doctor explained it, the patients passed away and they lit up with a bright glow surrounding them. Their eyes would shine with a silvery light. Then an odd mist would form over their chest and hover there for a moment. The doctor claimed that the mist had depth and a complex structure. He added that it seemed to have layers with an energetic motion within it. The second time this happened, the doctor sensed a presence standing beside him, seemingly waiting for the patient to die. A hospice psychologist interviewed by Dr. Moody believes that these misty clouds have an electrical component to them. Another nurse reported seeing a mist rising from many patients as they died, including her own father. She described the mist rising from his chest like a mist rising off a still river. It then hovered above him for a few seconds before dissipating. Other deathbed observers have also reported the bright glow that the Georgia doctor had witnessed. Dr. Moody interviewed another man near a deathbed who said the room became uncomfortably bright. It became so bright that he couldn't shut out the light even with his eyes closed. I think the one thing that, I'm sure it's not just me, why is it that this phenomenon wouldn't occur for everybody's death?
Yeah.
Because I'm sure there's millions of people who have been there in those final moments and didn't report seeing that, but yet then we have some others that do report seeing it. Why is it just some and not all?
Yeah, well, in this next one you're going to get to, it's like some people see different things entirely, or some people notice certain things that others don't. A bunch of people can be in the same room. Some can see it, some can't. So it's like, I don't know what it is that allows.
Is it like a psychic ability?
I don't know, yeah.
The individuals who observe it have, I don't know.
Yeah, are they tapped into something else that other people aren't? Yeah.
A hospice nurse once reported seeing a luminous presence floating near the bed, shaped somewhat like a person. A head nurse who had worked with this hospice nurse also reported seeing the same light in the room and light coming from the dying person's eyes. I mean, you always hear that, right? The seeing the light leave their eyes. Yeah. Or seeing the life leave their eyes, I think maybe is the other rendition of that. But some have written these reports off as hallucinations. But Dr. Moody points out that it's one thing to claim that a dying person is hallucinating. It's another thing to claim that the healthy people in the room have had the same shared hallucination. Dr. Moody believes that experiences like the mist and light phenomenon contribute to the key to proving the existence of an afterlife. A psychiatrist named Dr. Bernard Laubscher also reported on misty vapors and lights around deathbeds. Different medical caregivers had told him that while at the bedside of a dying person, they've seen the formation of a faint body of vapor. Some have even seen an elongated, whitish, purplish cloud. The formation often floats parallel with the dying person, about 2 feet above them. The mist becomes denser and takes on a sharper form, and it eventually looks like a replica of the person in the bed.
Yeah, that's
crazy. Wow.
Like, I mean, they're physically leaving.
Yeah.
It's something that is actually leaving.
Their spirits literally leaving their body. Yeah. Wow.
In one account, the cloud looked exactly like the dying person, especially the face. And some of the caregivers in the room also reported seeing a ribbon-like cord stretching from the back of the phantom's head connecting to the body below it. And as the mist was fully formed, the apparition would then begin glowing. According to these caregivers, some were more luminous than others, and they described an outline of light surrounding the mist almost like a neon tube. The more the mist developed, the cord that was connected from the head to the body below would begin to thin and fray. Some of the caregivers reported seeing smiling faces on the deceased. So the silver cord then severed, and the misty phantom would then dissipate.
You know what this reminds me of?
What's that?
umbilical cord.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's almost it's exactly like the metaphorical, but it's a death cord, right? Yeah.
Wow.
So this is really common, apparently. The silver cord is often used as a metaphor for someone's connection between their physical body and their soul or astral body. The term most likely comes from Ecclesiastes 12, 6 through 7 in the Jewish Bible or Christian Old Testament. There's a lack of consensus over its true meaning, but here it is translated from the original Hebrew, as close as I could find it. Quote, before the silver cord snaps and the golden fountain is shattered and the pitcher breaks at the fountain and the wheel falls shattered into the pit and the dust returns to the earth as it was and the spirit returns to God who gave it. The Bible had some bars back in the day. That's incredibly poetic. So no one knows exactly what it's referencing as the silver cord snapping, but they think that this is kind of where this comes from a bit. In these cases, the silver cord is an ethereal cord that is sometimes visible near the time of death. Witnesses claim it often looks like a strong, shimmering, silver elastic cord connected to the head or the stomach, which would also play into it, right? Yep. And it's typically about an inch or so wide. Some who have claimed to astral project, or those who have had out-of-body experiences, have also seen this cord connecting them to their bodies. Some believe this connection allows their astral body access to the Akashic Records, which is a supposed universal database containing the history of every soul and experience, which we've mentioned before. Yeah, everything. And as long as this connection remains intact, universal consciousness can be accessed through the astral plane. Some see it as a form of anchor point or lifeline so they won't lose their physical form. If you imagine it's just like a little tether when you're out, God knows where. Some see it as a metaphorical umbilical cord. But in the case of deathbed mist, instead of being born, the soul is being severed from the body as it dies. So this idea actually dates back to the ancient knowledge passed down from Eastern traditions, it's believed, where the cord weakens to the point of breaking, allowing the person to pass on.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that wild?
Yeah, just let that sink in for a second.
Seriously. Yeah, I didn't, I mean, it does make sense, especially metaphorically, like the umbilical cord, right? That's how we come into this world and it's severed. And then that's how we go out and it's severed.
It would make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
That this astral cord, the spectral cord is broken.
Yeah.
Another amazing moment.
Yeah.
Was cutting my daughter's umbilical cord.
I can only imagine.
I didn't think I was going to be able to do it, be able to stomach it.
But, a lot of fluids.
Yeah. Talk about a wild scene. Yeah. That's one I'll never forget.
Yeah.
But no, in the moment you're just like, this isn't crazy. This is like insane.
Yeah. I know. I've never experienced a birth myself, but I've heard it's very raw.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's just like as raw as human nature can get, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very graphic.
Yeah.
But very beautiful.
Right.
I mean, it brought me to tears. I was sobbing when my daughter was born. I was just like beside myself. Cause to see life come into the world and see your baby breathe its first breaths,
right?
It starts crying, and you're like, you're processing all this stuff. You're like, wait,
we can do this.
This just started from us having sex. And now we're, you're like, you just are going through all of these different thoughts. You're like, how did this happen?
Right.
This is so, it's like perfect. It's beautiful. Life is beautiful.
It is. And you did so much work.
I did a ton. So much work. So important. No, let's just say I have the way that I look at women now is just forever changed. I'm like, I could never do it. I'd be the worst pregnant person.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
It's so much work. It's an amazing thing though.
Respect to all the moms out there.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. And even those who didn't give bio birth.
Yeah.
You just, know?
Yeah. Being a mother is.
It's incredible.
Hardest job.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
So Dr. Laubscher believes that the mist, including the silver cord that they see, had the same makeup, this is kind of an antiquated take, I think, but as ectoplasm.
Love ectoplasm.
Yeah, you don't really hear about ectoplasm anymore. It kind of has been phased out of paranormal stuff, but
I don't think anybody's captured any ectoplasms recently.
No, that was his take. And if the person on the deathbed was more materialistic in life, apparently they would have a denser ectoplasm.
How does that compute?
Yeah, I don't know where he's coming up with that. And apparently they would have a more difficult time moving on.
Something they don't like want to leave behind their material possessions.
Right, right.
Well, too bad.
Yeah,
can't
sorry,
take it
buddy.
With you.
Yeah. So Dr. Peter Fenwick, who we mentioned, a British neuropsychiatrist, and his wife, Elizabeth Fenwick, they both wrote the book, The Art of Dying, 2008. In the book, they mention a similar phenomenon of mist that leaves the body at death, and they describe it much like the others do, but they emphasize that not everyone in the room can see it. They interviewed a woman named Penny Billcliffe, who was in the room when her sister passed. She described it saying, quote, "I saw a fast-moving will-o'-the-wisp appear to leave her body by the side of her mouth on the right. The shock and the beauty of it made me gasp. It appeared like a fluid or gaseous diamond, pristine, sparkly, and pure, akin to the view from above of an eddy in the clearest pool you can imagine. It moved rapidly upwards and was gone." Dr. R.B. Hout, a physician present at the death of his aunt, also witnessed a similar mist, and in the moments after his aunt passed, about 2 feet above the deathbed, a vague mist condensed into the shape of a human, and he saw what looked like the physical shape of his aunt. He described the form, saying, quote, "The features were very similar to the physical face, except that a glow of peace and vigor was expressed instead of age and pain. The eyes were closed as though in tranquil sleep, and a luminosity seemed to radiate from the spirit body." He also witnessed the silver cord, saying that, quote, "The color was a translucent, luminous silver radiance. The cord seemed alive with vibrant energy. I could see the pulsations of light stream along the course of it, from the direction of the physical body to the spirit double. With each pulsation, the spirit body became more alive and denser, whereas the physical body became quieter and more nearly lifeless. When the pulsation stopped, the strands of the cord began snapping. When the last strand gave way, the misty form rose up to a vertical position, smiled, and then disappeared."
Wow.
Yeah, that's quite a lot to witness.
Wow.
And yeah, a lot of these people, they're nurses, they're hospice workers, they're physicians.
Which you would expect they'd have a lot of experience with this.
Yeah.
So is it absolutely possible they had these experiences? Yeah, seems like it. I mean, I don't think any of us probably could, you know, even come close to the amount of experience.
Yeah.
Some of these medical professionals have. Yeah, to see physically someone's spirit leaving their body. I mean, my God.
Right. I mean, who am I to say? I have no idea.
So we are spiritual beings.
You think that's confirmed?
I mean, I would say so.
I would have no other explanation for what those forms would even be, right? Other than someone's soul ascending.
I don't know. Yeah. Like what other scientific explanation could you give it? It's not like they're vomiting or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like this is luminescent energy light basically.
Right.
Have you guys ever heard of the 21 grams experiment?
No.
It was an experiment in 1901 by Duncan McDougall,
a physician from Haverhill, Massachusetts, who wished to scientifically determine if a soul had weight.
That's crazy.
And essentially what he did is he weighed people while they were still alive and then weighed them basically immediately after their passing. And the reason it's called the 21 grams experiment is because he believed that the soul weighed exactly 21 grams. Now, he only did it with six people, and only one of the patients? One of the subjects. Only one of the subjects matched his hypothesis, and it was about 21.3 grams, and the rest were null. But he says that he needs to do a lot more research before it can be...
Yeah, I was going to say, it's only a handful of people.
It's a very small batch size.
Yeah, can you imagine asking someone, hey, on this person's deathbed, can I put them on a scale?
Can I weigh them?
You'd be like, get out of here, man.
Can I weigh them and tag them?
Right.
It's just,
Yeah.
He was also criticized for allegedly poisoning and killing 15 healthy dogs to support his medical research.
Damn. Yeah.
The reason I bring this up isn't to say that it was accurate. In fact, I want to say that a lot of people I've known a lot of people to name this study as proof that the soul exists, and it's just not true.
Mm.
But it did make me remember this because, you know, we're talking about the souls leaving the body.
Yeah,
we tried to scientifically measure it.
Right.
Yeah. Does the soul have any weight to it? I mean, it seems like if it's translucent and, you know, it seems like it would be weightless.
Yeah.
That's what I would think too.
This is just like a lump. It's just like a little lump inside of you, 21 gram
right,
lump.
Yeah.
Like what?
You just poop it out at the end?
Like what do you think happened to it then? How did it come out? How do you determine that? He's like, well, just disappeared. Yeah. Don't know where that 21 grams went.
And it's weird too, because he even had the belief that humans have souls and animals do not. So like... The dude was a wacko, let's be a little honest here.
Because we all know all dogs go to heaven.
Exactly.
Come on, get out of here.
I mean, a lot of people think their animals are, you know, reincarnated versions of...
Yeah, I've heard that.
...of their loved ones.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's easy to believe that.
It's comforting to believe that. Yeah.
That would, you know, if we come back as an animal, somebody's pet, or your loved one's pet, perhaps.
Damn.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I hope I'm treated well. I hope I can sleep all day and eat treats.
Seriously.
Poop in a yard. Sounds nice.
Yeah. I'm curious to see if anyone out there has any experiences with ELDVs.
Yeah.
Or has ever seen this spectral mist. Like, I'm sure there's somebody who listens to our show who's had some, is either works in hospice or has been with loved ones. During their final moments, and curious to hear if anybody has experienced any of these phenomena, because it's I don't know, it's kind of creepy, some of it, you know, like the little like mist coming out of the mouth, like if you didn't understand what you were looking at, didn't know that this was something that was studied before, or you'd be like, what's going on with grandma right now? This is weird. Like what is this stuff,
right?
But again, I don't remember seeing anything like that. But again, and maybe I missed it because that was the first time I was ever with somebody as they passed. So maybe something did happen and I just in the moment was focused on something else or thinking about something else that I missed, some sort of phenomenon that happened.
Yeah. It's odd that a lot of the experiences are generally similar too, like just something hovering just above. It makes me wonder if it's like the chicken or the egg type thing, like you've heard this story before, so then you see it and then you perpetuate the story so then others have it in their mind and see it, or if it's like that there's some validity to it because everyone's kind of seeing the same thing to some degree. I don't know, but it's quite odd that they're all so similar.
Yeah. There's this interesting thought that our souls like choose our bodies and choose our parents and stuff like that. That's always like, I remember reading about that before my daughter was born, and it's an idea that brings you a lot of joy because you're like, oh, she picked us.
They were chosen.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And then you think about yourself, you're like, did my soul pick my parents? And then you start thinking about why.
For what reason?
Yeah. For what reason? And then you kind of like start thinking about how your life has unfolded and, you know, different things that you've experienced if that was all part of the plan.
Yeah, that's great for self-reflection. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Getting very philosophical today.
Yeah, I mean, I think these types of discussions, it's a natural segue into
these. Well, it's like, I think there's this stigma around paranormal. If you ever talk to somebody who doesn't know anything about paranormal, and you're like, yeah, I'm really interested in the paranormal, like,
to me,
like, you like horror movies.
Yeah.
You probably worship the devil. You know, you believe in demons and all these different things, but it's like, no, the paranormal is just anything that we don't understand. It's
just kind of the unknown.
The mysterious, you know, mysteries of life in the universe is really what the paranormal is. Anything we can't explain.
Yeah.
There's just so much more to the paranormal than just all the terrifying hauntings and encounters with potentially negative entities and malevolent spirits. But
yeah, hope you like the curveball.
Yeah,
I think this is a good discussion.
I do too. I hope you leave a Lights Out episode every once in a while feeling good.
Yeah,
feeling uplifted. Yeah. You know, a little. Although we're about to take a very so enjoy that little burst of positivity because it gets back to regular schedule program here.
Yep, in a second. So if you want to take a moment to digest, do a little meditation between part one and part two, you're more than welcome. We could put it, you could do a little like old school Alfred Hitchcock intermission here. And then you come back for, we have a bit more conventional haunting coming up next.
Yeah. We'll see you in 15 minutes.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Well, switching gears into the Waverly Hills Sanatorium. So this is the other side of it. And it kind of goes back to our conversation earlier around the stone tape theory a little bit. We brought that up.
Yeah,
and definitely. This idea that there's this imprint left by, you know, those who pass. And the Waverly Hills Sanatorium certainly seems like a place where, due to the things that went on there and all of the horrible death and disease, just the traumatic ways that people died and the things that occurred, that it would make sense there'd be some imprint left over, whether you want to call it someone's soul or just the energy, the essence there left over. But it's definitely a spooky place for sure.
Yeah.
So the Waverly Hill Sanatorium in Louisville, Kentucky. This hospital operated from 1910 to 1961. Believe that. And during this time, the medical staff experienced some of the most bizarre hauntings ever recorded in a hospital. In the early 1900s, Jefferson County suffered from a massive tuberculosis outbreak, especially caused by Mycobacterium tuberculosis in the wetlands of the Ohio River. Tuberculosis, sometimes called TB or white death, is a bacterial infection contracted by breathing in air containing the Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Over 1 billion people have died from TB, which is a death toll greater than that from malaria, smallpox, HIV/AIDS, cholera, the plague, and influenza
combined.
Wow.
Crazy. I did not realize.
I didn't realize that either. That's insane.
I think that estimated number is approaching 2 billion too. Yeah, it's up there. I had no idea.
No, I didn't either.
That many people.
Some have even called it the plague of all plagues, which seems somewhat appropriate. Luckily, with the introduction of antibiotic medication and vaccines, TB has become more preventable and curable. But in the early 1920s, US, this was not the case. By 1926, a larger five-story medical structure that could hold 400 patients was built due to a lack of space and structural concerns of the original building. And they built the new sanatorium upon a hill away from the wetlands, surrounded by a quiet, open space where patients could relax. They're surrounded by fields, trees, and fresh air. They even grew their own food and raised their own animals. This is a massive building.
Huge.
At the time, it was considered the most advanced tuberculosis sanatorium in the country. But many, many patients still died from TB here. Sadly, the sanatorium wasn't only for treatment. It was a place to isolate those who had come down with the disease to keep them away from those who had not. So basically a place to quarantine.
Yeah.
And visitors could only see their loved ones on designated visitors' days. Even the doctors and nurses were often confined to the property because TB was that contagious.
God.
Despite the dire circumstances, the facility tried to give the patients hope. They had movie nights, crafts, and luncheons with music and dancing. They even offered classes to the patients, preparing them for the workforce, when or if they ever left the hospital alive. There was also reportedly a special department inside the hospital where adult TB patients could keep their uninfected children if no one else could watch them. Wow.
Yeah.
Such God. A... This whole time period is just insane. Yeah.
So crazy. But yeah, so at the time, you know, this also, as we go back in medical science, I feel like so much has changed in like the past 100 years. It's crazy.
Massive leaps in.
Huge, huge. So at the time, fresh air combined with sun exposure was a common treatment. Which just get out.
Yeah. That's just being a human, being a good human every day. Just yeah. Get outside just and breathe some fresh air
in the sun. Yeah. But I mean, that just shows how little they knew, like how they understood this. But a man named Doug Steele reported on his firsthand experience, saying that a lot of bed rest was out on the solarium porches, and these did not have glassed-in windows. The patients spent most of their stays out on these porches, and this included all four seasons. Some patients would even be left outside in freezing temperatures covered in snow. So solarium,
like rain or shine.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
As long as the sun's out, you're out.
Right.
God.
So this hospital, it had like these solarium rooms where, all the windows
like a green
were
room
busted
kind of
busted out.
Yeah,
yeah, it's kind of like a sun porch a little bit. And then they also actually had like sun porches up on the rooftop where they could go out and hang out. So because they thought fresh air, sun. And since like it was sometimes these patients were a little bit immobile, they'd just be like, hey, go to the solarium, catch some sun and fresh air.
I would love to know what their science was behind that.
Yeah. So.
These poor people are getting like sunburned and.
Right. Yeah. Left out in the snow all day. Yeah. I don't know. Some treatments, which now seem barbaric, were sometimes as brutal as the symptoms. Alleged experimental treatments included exposing a patient's lungs to direct UV light. The idea was that sitting in the sun was a potential treatment. This was called heliotherapy.
Does that, they mean like they had an open wound on their chest?
This is an alleged.
With their lungs?
This is
what
like an
hell?
Alleged experimental.
Or just
I don't think
bare
this
chested?
Happened. I think this is one of the exaggerated claims in this, but the idea was that, you know, let's just expose the affected area, which was the lungs, to direct UV light.
Because that'll take care of it.
Yeah.
My God.
In other alleged experimental treatments, balloons would be surgically implanted in the lungs and then filled with air to expand them. Again, alleged. So an actual recorded treatment was called artificial pneumothorax. Doctors would inject nitrogen into the lungs, forcing them to collapse. And the idea was that the holes that were believed to cause TB would close up. One doctor said it allowed for the lungs to, quote, rest
forever.
You like collapse what? Someone's
yeah,
lungs.
Jesus.
They really just didn't know.
They're just what throwing spaghetti at the wall hoping it sticks.
They're like, I have identified TB to the lungs, and beyond that we're just kind of at a loss. And in a last resort, doctors would perform what's called thoracoplasty, where they would open up the chest and remove muscles and even ribs to allow the lungs to expand further and even collapse them when deemed necessary by a doctor. Most patients, on average, would require the removal of 7 to 8 ribs, apparently, and the surgeons felt it safe only to remove 2 or 3 ribs at a time. So this meant that sometimes patients had to endure several surgeries before the whole procedure could be completed.
What the hell?
Isn't that crazy?
It's like, and they're like, maybe it'll work.
Maybe.
We'll see.
How many ribs can you actually live without?
I don't know.
Because 7 to 8? Is that how many you have?
That's like exposing a huge chunk.
Like 8?
I don't know.
So just take out the whole rib cage. What the hell?
Man, thank God for modern medicine, because this is a nightmare going back in time. We just had no idea what we were doing.
And they're probably doing this under the guise of, this will help.
Right, right. It's in the lungs.
Somebody's so desperate for help, they're like, yeah. And then just making things a million times worse and probably leading to their death.
Right.
Being a lot quicker than.
But I could see, like, if I was a patient, like, people are kind of dropping like flies from this.
Why not?
Like, I'd be like, doc, do whatever you think will help at this rate.
Going back to how deadly tuberculosis is, the World Health Organization published a report in 2024 regarding it, and they stated that tuberculosis took the lead as the leading infectious disease killer in 2023, surpassing even COVID-19.
Yeah.
So it's still very prevalent out there. Yeah.
Wow. Well, let's talk about just how creepy this sanatorium is. Because those who didn't survive TB, which was a lot, as we were just talking about, were allegedly sent to what's called the Body Chute, a 485-foot tunnel that led from the hospital to the railroad tracks at the base of the hill. For a time, it was a way to quickly transport supplies and equipment to the hospital, but when, you know, the numbers just started getting out of control. I mean, at the height of the TB epidemic at the time, I mean, the death toll was insane. So they had to figure out a way to get bodies out of there far quicker. So the bodies were moved through the tunnel in secret using a motorized rail and cable system, so the newcomers couldn't see how many deceased were leaving the hospital. That's crazy.
Yeah. Like,
never saw him leave.
No.
Where'd he go?
485-foot tunnel too, which people have gone down here in the tours and stuff. It's quite creepy just being in there.
Well, it gets even creepier because we're going to be talking about the draining room, which is an alleged haunted area in Waverly Hills. It was located near the morgue, and this room is approximately 15 feet long, 15 feet wide, and 20 feet from the floor to ceiling. And there were 8 poles that were vertically connected between the ceiling and the floor. And after a patient died, medical staff would hang the bodies on these tall poles in the room, and drains had also been installed into the floors below. According to the legend, the room was created to clean the deceased of infected fluids before sending him through the death chute and back into town. The workers then would cut the bodies from the sternum to the groin to allow all the fluids to drain. Allegedly, so many of the locals in Jefferson County were so scared of TB that they didn't even want the bodies returning to town. And since so many bodies had been removed from the hospital, it didn't have its own cemetery. Local officials were forced to authorize the best compromise they could, so this was it somehow. We'll make a draining room so that we can reassure people that we're taking care of TB before the bodies are coming. And so that, which, any science behind that whatsoever?
No.
After TB had become less dire in the middle of the century, the room was allegedly transformed into a slaughter room for farm animals that they raised on the property. That's what it sounds like. It's just a slaughter room where you hang animals up on.
Right.
Some have reported seeing apparitions hanging from the poles. Others have heard invisible liquids flowing into the drains in the floor. But don't worry, because the existence of this room was later debunked. Medical facilities were not in charge of processing bodies this way because they're not qualified.
I've never heard of this before.
Well, and according to the mechanical drawings of Waverly Hills, this room was designated as the transformer room, where the large holes in the walls allowed electrical wiring to pass through. The large metal door connecting the room is also clearly stamped with fire protection. The draining room is one of many exaggerations surrounding the property. Another is just the sheer number of deaths at Waverly Hills. A fairly accurate estimate is about 6,000 to 8,000 deaths, which is still
a ton. Yeah.
Insane amount.
Why do you even have to exaggerate that? That's a ton of people.
But on an episode of Ghost Hunters, they continued a myth that 63,000 people had died there. This would have meant that 3 to 4 people would have died every single day the hospital is open. What on
earth? That's ridiculous.
This would have, yeah. What?
I don't know why we have to exaggerate death tolls. Because
it makes
like
it
that.
Scarier.
I guess.
6,000 to 8,000 deaths is still pretty horrible.
That's a lot
horrible.
Of people. Yeah.
According to Dr. J. Frank Stewart, a former assistant medical director of the hospital, the highest number of deaths at Waverly Hills in a single year was 152. After the introduction of antibiotic treatment, the death count in 1955 was down to 42. And reportedly, the highest amount of patients inside the hospital at any given time was documented to be 478. Yeah, how do you even get to 63,000?
Yeah, come on. It's already like so many people. Like even the highest amount of patients at 478 tuberculosis patients, that's incredible. That's so many people. I don't feel the need to exaggerate that number anymore.
No. And how does that change anything?
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't change.
It's kind of silly.
Yeah. By 1961, Waverly Hills had closed down, but was reopened a year later as Woodhaven Geriatrics Sanatorium, which focused on elderly care. Many rumors about patient mistreatment and unusual experiments spread during the following years. Due to budget cuts in the 60s and 70s, the conditions got even worse, and the state closed the facility permanently in 1982, which thank God they closed these facilities down. Because a lot of these places did end up having a ton of abuse going on. Yeah,
even today.
Yes.
Even today, places
very
like this.
True. Yeah. Very true. Lots of malpractice going on.
Yeah.
In March 1996, Robert Albert Haskey, who ran Christ the Redeemer Foundation Incorporated, bought Waverly Hills and the surrounding area, and he planned to build the largest statue of Jesus on the site, along with an arts and worship center.
What?
What does he want? The Christ the Redeemer statue?
Yeah, he does. Yeah. Even larger.
Rio de Janeiro? Like, come on.
Yep. This is hilarious to me that also, like, why on this property, man?
How about we just make it a peaceful cemetery or like
a memorial?
A memorial. Yeah. Just like somewhere where people can go and, you know, be with their loved ones. Why do we got a giant statue of Jesus there?
Yeah, it seems odd. Why would you even? I mean, I get it.
It's going to turn into a tourist attraction.
Right. Yeah.
People are just going to tour in there, trash the place. So.
Yeah.
And they planned for the statue to be 150 feet tall. Bigger than Christ the Redeemer in Brazil. It was estimated to cost $4 million and the rest of the property renovations was estimated at $8 million. But the plans were canceled in 97 because the donations to the project fell short. Oh, he's trying to fundraise this, dude.
Yeah.
He only raised $3,000.
GoFundMe. I'm building the largest Jesus statue in the
Literally.
U.S.
Literally.
Yeah.
Only raised $3,000.
That's so funny to me.
Oh, my Lord.
He could only get $3,000. Because, I mean, anyone who looks, even the promotional pictures look ridiculous, man. It's ridiculous.
And literally just copied Christ the Redeemer.
Yeah. And it's like, we already have a large statue of Jesus. Just go to the original one that's already there.
Why does Jesus got to be so large? What about pocket Jesus?
Yeah.
We can't just have Jesus around our necks and close to our hearts. Why does he got to be like towering over
150 feet tall? Yeah, come on.
And he wanted to make it out of stainless steel.
That is hilarious. Oh my God.
Yeah, they'll turn into an airplane graveyard.
Yeah.
That's so silly. My eyes.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Jesus.
I do want to go to Rio de Janeiro one day and see the actual Christ the Redeemer statue because it looks beautiful where it is.
I saw a huge statue like this in Thailand, not of Jesus, of Buddha, though.
Nice.
And that was sick.
Yeah. That's awesome. Then they usually put them in like really beautiful places. Not to say that Louisville, Kentucky isn't a beautiful place, but.
Hey, man, they got some great horse racing out there.
Yeah,
some
true.
Great whiskey.
True. I'm not slamming Louisville. I'm just saying, why do we want a massive statue of Jesus? It's probably going to be kind of an eyesore on the property of a tuberculosis ward. Like, come on. We don't need this.
And isn't this kind of like, it's assuming that everybody, doesn't kind of assume everybody believes in Jesus to some extent too? Like, why Jesus? Like, depending on what your beliefs are, you might think he's the son of God, or you might just think he was a great man, a prophet, a teacher, whatever it may be. But what if you have, you know, people of other faiths who died there?
Yeah.
Do they get to erect their own statue?
Right.
Is there going to be a Buddha one there and, you know, a Muhammad one? Like,
That would, now we're talking. Did we, what if we pooled a ton of money we got? Well, we can't depict Muhammad. We would get in trouble for that. Right. So we could do, we could do replica Mecca with Christ the Redeemer, 200 feet tall, Buddha right next to him, who's a big Hindu,
Krishna?
We can rock Krishna.
There you go.
Get them all there. We'll do a Mount Rushmore.
Like around a campfire too.
Yeah.
You know, just hanging out.
Chilling. And then we'll get like Old Testament God, or we'll get like Noah or something. Noah in the Ark, something
well,
like
that.
Well,
they do have a huge ark down there.
So yeah, you know? True.
So they already got that going.
So they got that. We'll just move it. We'll move it to our
When
thing.
The Jesus statue didn't work out, somebody was like, dude, we got to have Noah's Ark. Full scale here. Yeah,
full scale.
But it's a huge tour.
With the animals. Get the animals here
that
too.
That would be, that's taking it to the next level.
Yeah.
Noah's Ark, it's a zoo.
Yeah.
Every animal on the planet. Damn.
All right. This is going to be my life goal. The Mount Rushmore of religions in Louisville, Kentucky. We're going to make it happen.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
But back to Waverly Sanatorium. It was sold to Tina and Charlie Mattingly in 2001. And they were like, haunted ghost adventure attraction. But what, you know, and then the profits they make from it go towards the renovation. So it's
which
like
I
this.
Think is cool.
Yeah. Let's restore the building. You know, we know what's going to get people to come. Plus people are probably already sneaking in there anyway to do ghost hunting and stuff.
They were, yeah.
So I can think of worse ways.
Yeah. No, I like that.
At least they're restoring it and preserving. Although I think someone would argue, why don't we just knock this
yeah,
down?
Why is it here?
There's a lot of death here.
Yeah, I wonder, like, what?
How about just a nice park?
That'd be nice. I like
a park
that
families can enjoy, you know.
I like that. That's a good idea.
With Jesus in the middle.
I mean, I do have a
Jesus in the middle of the pond.
Yeah, there we go. We got to have Jesus somewhere. I do like, I'm a sucker for older buildings though, like early 1900s buildings. Like I do think there's some historical preservation at play.
It's kind of an artifact.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I don't know what you would do with a building like this. It's massive though. And I mean, it does.
I know what you do with it. You make it a homeless shelter.
Yeah. You could do something
like that. Do something good with it.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, you could turn this into what? I don't know. A museum.
Escape room.
Just a bunch of escape rooms. So I'd be curious what they're eventually, like once they kind of fix it all up.
Or an old folks
place
home.
The windows. Yeah, like what, I wonder what you could
it's
do
out on
with
some
this.
Nice property, so.
Maybe some community projects in there of some kind. I don't know.
A commune for the next cult leader.
There we go. I'm
there's
down.
There's a lot of possibilities.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you're probably wondering, guys, I just want to hear about the hauntings of this place. Tell us what's going on. What lurks within this place?
So many odd paranormal experiences have been witnessed at Waverly Hills Sanatorium even before it shut its doors. At its peak of TB deaths, there was an alleged story from a nurse who recalled many of the patients who had died from TB and were sent through the body chute. Some of these patients would then reappear at night at the foot of their previous hospital beds. Many appeared to be smiling and healthy, then they would vanish as fast as they had appeared. A similar story came from a doctor who worked at the hospital in the 1930s. He reported hearing faint whispers in the dead of night. Then phantoms of the previously deceased would appear, sometimes only hours after their death. One of the ghosts quickly became famous at Waverly Hills. The ghost of a young boy, Timmy, who passed from TB at a young age. When Timmy was alive, he liked to spend time outside getting fresh air and playing catch with whoever would join him. It said that if you roll a ball down one of the long hospital hallways, Timmy will actually roll the ball back to you. But not every ghost at Waverly Hills is as kind as Timmy, but we actually have some sightings on video of specifically of kind of smaller entities or possibly child apparitions, something along that. So we're going to...
Who took these?
Show you. Yeah, I don't know who took this first one. I'm going to have to... Let me see if I can find this. Oh. So this is a radio station 102.3 The Max captured what appears to be apparitions of children. Yeah.
Radio station gone paranormal.
Yeah, man. Right? So let's see if how legit this is.
We were taking a tour group through Waverly Hills, and you can see them here, people walking through a doorway into the hallway. We have one thermal imaging camera. It is stationary the entire time. And Doug, who is running the camera, is in a room right next to the camera with his laptop. Now, as people walk up and down the hall, look in rooms and stuff, they start going the other way, and the hallway clears. After 30 seconds, you'll see the time skip here. There appears two smaller, much shorter images. Doug steps out immediately with the camera, looks in the hallway. There's nothing there. He moves the camera back and forth to try to catch anything. The images move around and then simply disappear into the wall.
Whoa.
Isn't that crazy?
Whoa.
My only complaint is why didn't they show the other camera showing nothing down the hall? I wish they would have shown that footage of where there was no.
I wish they would have bumped the contrast a bit on them.
Or increased, maybe get an HD.
Yeah, I think this footage was taken like 10 plus years ago. Yeah. What was the timestamp? Like 06 or something?
Yeah, it's an old one. And I don't know if that was a re-upload or not, but that's an old, some old footage. But hey, if, 102.3 The Max, if you could re-upload that in HD, I would love that. But I don't know. What do you think? What do you take from that? Just the two children randomly appearing.
I think categorizing them as children is very tough. Looks like two blobs.
Yeah, it's hard to see.
I don't know that I could define the age on those spirits from that far away.
Yeah, that's fair.
And to me, it looked very similar to when actual humans were walking in front of the camera. Like it's very faint and you could kind of see because obviously nobody was there. They'd gone into the rooms and then there's these two little things. But I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. Could be.
I don't know.
Who am I to say that it wasn't two children?
True, true.
Just playing ball in the hallway.
Could have been. But this next clip, this is investigation on June 5th, 2011 from the United Paranormal Project. And they caught this really weird entity. I think, was this the third floor, I believe? 2011. Let's check this out. So for those listening, we're just kind of seeing a hallway, a bit dilapidated.
Oh!
Did you see it?
Nope, I missed it.
It'll play a slowed down version here in a second.
God, the paranormal's quick.
You gotta stay on your toes.
Wait.
All right, yeah, here, you'll see it.
All right, that's weird.
It goes really fast across the hall.
That was slowed down a lot.
Yeah.
Which, again, the paranormal's usually not seen live in person. It's caught, you know, you review the footage and you see it later.
Right. Pretty odd.
Yeah. I don't know what that was. I don't know either. Yeah. I would probably either say it's a rat or it is something unexplained. A rat, that's too fast for a rat. I don't know. That would be a fast rat.
It would be a fast rat, but my vote's for a rodent. I don't know.
Play it one more time.
It looks like it's kind of upright, though. Yeah, blinking, you'll miss it. You should play the regular.
All right, I'm going to pay attention really well.
Don't blink.
Oh!
What the hell? Okay. What the hell?
What is that? It does look like it crosses the hall and goes into one of the rooms, too.
That's strange. I don't know. I've never seen a rat move that quick. Yeah. It'd be too tall for, unless it was on its hind legs. Like
it's like Looney Tunes across the hall.
Runs across.
Yeah.
See, I don't know what that is. It's like it's upright, but then it goes down on all fours. So it could have been a rat running upright and then let's just
get... Damn. Fucking Speedy Gonzales out there.
It looks too small to be like a child. Like maybe like an infant, but...
Hmm. Demon. I don't know.
It's a demon. It's a demon. Yeah. I would call it an anomaly. It could be a little alien for all we know. A little gray alien. Or
seriously.
Yeah, that's weird. That's really weird.
Definitely odd.
I'd have to look at a list of animals that to live in this area. I'm sure they have rodent problems at this place.
Yeah.
So it possibly could be something quick like that.
That's true. There's also...
Because it's far enough away that there's no definition in the image.
Mm.
You know, it's just like, again, a blob.
Yeah.
A dark blob. But it does look like it was standing, or it was like, it was taller at the beginning. And then it kind of moves to the floor.
Right. And it doesn't look like it's just a trick of the camera or something, because it looks like it's an actual entity or something that moves from one end of the hall into... It kind of looks like it goes into that room.
Right. Almost. Well, my first thought was it was just a fly that flew in front of the camera or something. But then when you watch it real close,
it's like a beginning and end.
There's depth to it. So it's clearly not right in front of the camera, or... Obviously, if it was way back there in that hallway, you wouldn't see it. But so that's obviously something.
Yeah.
It's almost as if something ran out or flew across there, noticed it was being filmed, and then hit the deck. It's like, no,
get down.
Yeah. That's wild, though.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, that's a wild one. So another ghost who is often seen inside the hospital is a woman who once worked as a nurse, and she had allegedly taken her own life in 1928 inside the building and continued to terrorize the hospital rooms and hallways after death. So in another story dating back to 1932, another nurse apparently jumped from the roof patio and fell to her death. It's unclear why she would have done this, so many suspect she was actually pushed to her death. Her phantom can still be witnessed on the fifth floor patio area. Other spirits include a little girl seen running around the third floor solarium, a hearse, which I mean, hey, that was the third floor, so I wonder if that had anything to do with it. Another one is a hearse that appears in the back of the building dropping off coffins. And another is a woman in white, apparently bleeding from her wrists, crying for help. Others heard the ghost of a maintenance man named Ralph, who used to work at the sanatorium. His keys can be heard jingling down long corridors, although his apparition is rarely seen. So after the sanatorium closed, the building fell into disrepair, and the legends of paranormal activity at the property got even worse. One legend told of a man in a white coat, presumably a former doctor, who was seen walking in the cafeteria and kitchen area. Those who have seen him also report the smell of food, even though the kitchen was, you know, in complete disarray. Broken windows, fallen plaster, broken tables and chairs, and puddles of water and debris from a leaking roof have cluttered the kitchen. I think it's a bit more cleaned up now, but it was like that for a time. And the adjacent cafeteria was in a similar condition, but the man could once be seen walking as if the place was still in operation and there was no clutter around. Visitors have also reported footsteps in empty rooms, a door swinging shut on its own, and the smell of freshly baked bread. An investigation by Louisiana spirits discovered orbs in their photography and observed record high amounts of electronic voice phenomena through their spirit boxes. Throughout the night, they heard countless disembodied voices, and several members heard what sounded like children's laughter. One investigator also bent down to pick up a toy ball and heard a loud another investigator confirmed hearing that same noise as well. In recent years, an anonymous volunteer who worked on various tours and investigations at Waverly Hills explained, quote, "It doesn't matter who you are or what your beliefs are, things happen in that building that are not explainable. I have seen people get possessed, and I have had something attempt to take control of me as well. I have heard voices with nobody around. I have smelled cigars when nobody was smoking. I've been pushed up against a wall, seen a doppelganger, and watched inanimate objects move on their own. Other visitors have witnessed slamming doors, lights in the windows as if the power was on, and eerie footsteps in empty rooms." Apparently, the morgue down there has also had some activity. Some visitors have even gotten inside the body storage drawers. You know, you've seen like kind of like the classic morgue where it's like a big tray that they pull the bodies out of the wall and they push.
You want to get in one of those?
I don't, but apparently some visitors have, and they have experienced the rolling storage platforms kind of moving on their own, trying to close them inside the wall. Yeah.
Seems like we should have done our paranormal investigation here.
Yeah, this is terrifying.
This is crazy. Well, it's, guess how much they paid for this too?
How much?
$230,000.
What?
In 2001.
Ah.
So with inflation, $2.3 million today. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. That is a good investment.
But they bought it for $230,000. Would you buy it for $230,000?
If I had some screw-off money, maybe.
Why not? Then they bought the adjacent, like, bunch of acreage adjacent to it for $800,000. But for $1 million, they have this huge sprawling property in this gigantic haunted hospital.
That's pretty cool. I mean, I would go and live in it and then set up like my operations, like do the paranormal tours and everything, run that as my business or something.
Yeah. I mean, that's not a bad deal. But the most documented paranormal experiences at Waverly Hills comes from the fifth floor. While many rumors mention the fifth floor was once used for mentally ill TB patients who were locked in their rooms, this was later debunked. TB patients were allowed to roam around and access the patio roof for sun and fresh air. The floor had two nurses' stations, a pantry, a linen room, a medicine room, and two medium-sized rooms on both sides of the nurses' stations. One of these, room 502 specifically, stirred up rumors and legends. Any visitor to Waverly Hills over the years, either tour guests or trespassers, have wanted to see this room for themselves. From the outside, people have seen shapes moving past the windows in 502. The current co-owner, Tina Mattingly, has seen the light in 502 turn on and off on its own. While inside, many visitors have also heard disembodied voices. It's said that the infamous ghost of the nurse who ended her life in 1928 can be found here. It's believed her name was Mary Hillenberg. She was 29 at the time, unmarried and pregnant. According to one story, Mary had gotten pregnant by one of the doctors who was married to another woman. That doctor then tried to perform an abortion on her, but Mary died during the procedure. The doctor then propped her body up in the room to look like she had died from hanging. In the years since, humanoid shapes have been seen in and around room 502, and some have even heard a woman's voice whisper, "Get out." EMF readings also typically spike near 502. What's odd is that there is no Kentucky state death record of anyone named Mary Hillenberg between 1911 and 2000, but this might not debunk the story. According to Patty Starr in her book Ghost Hunting Kentucky, the co-owner, Charles Mattingly, met a man named John Thornberry. His father worked for the sanatorium, and John worked there for a time, starting when he was 17. You might have been 17 working here?
Oof.
Whew. Charlie claimed that John told him he was the one who discovered Mary's body in room 502. He also discovered the discarded remains of the abortion. And allegedly, the situation was so horrific and taboo that it wasn't even officially reported to the state. Now the ghost of Mary is believed to be one of the strongest paranormal forces in the entire building. Today, the Waverly Hills Sanatorium property is still open to the public for historical tours, paranormal tours, and a six-hour semi-guided public investigation. It's still considered one of the most haunted hospitals in the United States. And I know there's somebody out there who's been here.
Yeah, there has to be a listener who's been here. This is a big hospital.
I'd check it out.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I think all three of us are wanting to experience some of this. 100%.
Yeah, definitely. Also, just the history. And the history that's building alone. Totally. Is wild.
Yeah, I mean, again, it goes back to when you look at the history, the haunting makes sense.
Right. Yeah.
You know, no matter what theory you believe behind the cause for hauntings, I think there's any place that's going to be haunted, it's one where thousands of people have died and suffered, and there was all this, you know, negative energy and just suffering going on. It would make sense that, you know, it is in fact an imprint of that.
Yeah, that I agree.
It's a residual haunting, basically. Yeah, next level, man.
Next level. I mean, I would love to visit this place.
We go back to the first part of this episode.
Yeah, I know, right? But yeah, like I said, I am a sucker for 1900s buildings, especially in the U.S., because we tend to just, we've knocked down so many, we just don't preserve them.
But people want to live in modern homes.
I don't. I know. I never want to live in a modern built play school construction house.
You want
ever.
Those baseboard heaters forever.
I want radiation heat. Radiators and drafty windows. I like that stuff.
I'm surprised you haven't lived in a haunted house yet.
No, which is funny because my house in Hamtramck, as far as the records show, that was like a 100-year-old house. And never really experienced anything. I mean, I would joke about
it. But maybe you just weren't open to it, Austin.
Maybe I wasn't.
Maybe shit was really going down and you just
were just oblivious to it. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's not really like a creepy house at all. It's kind of smaller and it did have a huge attic. There was like an unfinished second floor.
Was there a box with old tapes in it?
Yeah.
Did you watch?
Yeah. And like a creepy lady crawled out of my TV when I started watching them. But no, I don't know. I really like old buildings.
We're going to make a t-shirt that says Austin really likes old buildings.
Yeah. But you go even downtown Denver.
No, I agree. You know, I agree. I love old churches.
They're historic.
Stained glass, big cathedral. You know.
We were trying to, I mean, especially with churches, like, I mean, believer or not, they're some of the most beautiful buildings ever because like the people constructing those buildings are like, this is for God.
Yeah, it's not in a strip mall.
Yeah. So it's like, I'm going to construct the most beautiful thing I possibly can.
God's temple is supposed to look like God's temple. Yeah, exactly. It's not supposed to be next door to the Domino's. No, all right. No. I'm throwing shade at churches right now. It bothers me. You know, people should gather wherever they want to gather. Yeah, and that's sometimes the only place they can do it.
Yeah, there's also economic restrictions.
There's economic restrictions, yeah, but yeah. I think there's something to be said about there was a lot of time, effort, and love put into these historical buildings.
Yeah.
And,
I mean, even you go down to Denver, like the Mint building down there.
Right, the Mint building.
It's the Capitol building. It's like, you're like, holy crap, man.
Brown Palace.
We used to, what's the Brown Palace?
I've been. Another historical hotel.
Mm-hmm.
We went to a historical hotel for our holiday party too.
Yeah, true.
That was old.
I remember that. That was cool.
Yeah.
That's a cool building.
Right.
Yeah, we just.
Versus the Hilton Inn conference room. Yeah, you know. I get it. I love the charm.
Yeah.
I would honestly live in a Victorian house.
That would be
crazy.
I think
they're sick.
Yeah.
With all the modern creature comforts.
Yeah. Heated floors.
Yeah. AC, yeah. Central air.
Yeah. I love that kind of like, I don't know, early 19, mid-century. Everyone used like wood. It's all like natural wood and it's
usually like hand carvings and like the railings. Nothing was like
the molding is crazy. Yeah. Yeah.
Mass manufactured by machines. It was like human hands that like carved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like that stuff.
Fireplaces, which aren't really a thing anymore.
My God. I'm a sucker for a nice chimney.
I know. I can't wait till I have to explain to my daughter how Santa gets in.
Yeah.
Well,
he just knocks on the front door, I guess.
He comes in through the router.
He turns into a Wi-Fi
through the internet. Yeah.
Pops out of your iPad.
Yeah.
No, I get it, man. I take it you're not a big fan of like modern minimal sort of aesthetic and architecture.
I think it depends. I really like, there's the whole millennial gray thing, which I love have like tried to push back against finally. And I'm like, yeah, why did we ever do this, man? But there can be like really nice modern interior designs and architecture that you could tell somebody put some effort into. So I'm not completely against it. I just think there are just so many houses, and for more than one reason. Like I get why we're building
houses. It's economics.
Is what it is.
If it was affordable to build an artistic house of quality,
right,
everybody would do it. Nobody would want to buy a mass-produced home that's all the same, cookie cutter, you know what I mean?
And I think it's more indicative of like, not to get into it, but just like, you know, how strong our like the middle class and the working class is now, and like we're just at the housing shortage, so we're just building all these really crappy cheap homes. Because even when I look back at my Hamtramck house, it's a small house, and that was like the working man's house, because that was just a bunch of auto workers who used to work there. And
yeah,
it's a big immigration hub. It was just like Polish immigrants coming to America and living in these smaller homes, but they still just kind of gave at least a little bit of a crap, where there's like pine and oak molding and they had like a built-in cabinet set in the kitchen. So like they at least like tried a little bit more, where now everything's just cheap and
Well, you were a home inspector too, so you know.
Yeah, yeah, true, yeah.
That these new homes that are brand new are
They're busted
most of the time.
I mean, have you caught some of those videos? Like,
yeah,
they'll be like, this was a new build and some guy's inspecting it and it's just a bunch of bullshit.
There's just a fucking hole in the roof with water running down.
Yeah, you probably saw the same one I did.
You're like, what the hell is this?
Why is it like this?
So get your home inspection.
Yeah, seriously. But yeah.
It's not quality anymore. Yeah.
I think we just kind of gave a little bit more of a crap about architecture and our buildings. And now it's just strictly for necessity.
Yeah.
Back then it was a bit more like, how do I make this a home?
So buy old homes.
Cliche or anything. But yeah.
That's the message today.
I'm a big proponent. If you could find a place.
Death can be peaceful and uplifting.
And buy old homes. Yeah. Good bones, right? Good bones. But yeah, that's my message. I don't know how we got so far off track. I think we just started talking about Waverly. Because it is really, if you look at, go look at some pictures of this place. It's, even though it's run down now, like the original pictures are.
Took some effort to build.
Yeah, it's kind of breathtaking.
I don't know about the inside. I mean, the inside's still not breathtaking but.
Oh, that's probably also a poor choice of words on my part for tuberculosis word. It's breathtaking. God.
We better get out of here before we get ourselves into trouble here.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, let us know your thoughts on everything discussed. Old homes, deathbeds, to haunting at Waverly Hills Sanatorium. We want to hear it. I'm sure there's somebody out there who's been there. I'm really curious, though, if anybody's done the haunted tour there.
Yeah.
What they thought of it, and if they recommend we get out there at some point. That'd be definitely on my list of places to check out. But
same.
But yeah, that's it for us today. Thanks for joining us. It was a good time.
It was a mixed bag episode today.
You know, sometimes you just need those. You just got to mix it up and just kind of see where it is a podcast after all.
Yeah, true.
Just go where the conversation takes you.
I like it.
No matter how wild it is.
I like it.
But yeah, we'll see you guys next week. Until then, lights out, everybody.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.